morning, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started here. Currently with us are Representative Newman, Representative Thompson, Representative Edgman, Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Holmes, Representative Costello, and myself, Representative Osterman. I expect other members to join us as we go along. My objective this morning, and even though I'm 4 minutes late, I'm going to be trying to get these meetings started on time. We've got a lot of work to do this year, and I'd appreciate if everybody would pay attention to the time and show up and get ready to go. today we're going to be hearing from the Department of Health and Social Services. Really, as most of you know, this committee has served as a subcommittee on this department, and we're going to continue that same process through the rest of this legislative session. And Representative Newman will be chairing the meetings on HES up through the time we get the budget done. And the next meeting that we're planning on having will be on Thursday at 1:30 in the afternoon with the Karen Redfield, the Director of Office of Management and Budget. As most of you know, as we go through this process, both Representative Stoltz and myself get caught up in other meetings, both with the Senate, with the Governor, and with the leadership, and that's happening this morning as well. So after I turn this meeting over to Representative Newman, I will be leaving and joining Representative Stoltz down at a meeting of leadership. So Representative Higgins, I see you're in the audience, and you can join us at any point in time. Representative Munoz is not here yet. If you want to sit in her seat until she shows up, we can play a little musical chairs if you want. Or you can move over to Representative Newman's chair when I leave here. So.
Okay.
Is there anything that the committee wants to bring forward before we get started this morning? All right, seeing that, then I turn the chair over to Representative Newman. Mr. Representative Newman.
Thank you and welcome. To the House Finance Budget Overview Committee meetings. Today we're going to hear from Commissioner Struer, just a basic overview. And as you're all very well aware, we spent the summer looking at the budget in multiple ways and in different areas of the state. Today what we're going to try and do is just have a basic overview and a discussion with the commissioner. And what I've asked the commissioner and his staff to help us present this year is a discussion on how we can develop a five-year budget. That's our goal here, and we should all be pretty familiar with the different divisions now within a department. And I want to get away from the basic boilerplate discussions that we have in the presentations. We all know what they are, and if you don't, we can go back and look and get you that stuff. But we want to start having a more basic, down-to-earth discussion, a communicative type discussion with the department on how we're going to move forward on this. We've got a lot of things to look at here. So with that, Commissioner Struer, do you want to come up and introduce your staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Struer, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, and it seems like only yesterday I was with you all, so it's...
Like only yesterday we were having meetings, huh?
Some things you remember so much better, Mr. Chairman, because of the experience. With me is Sam Eford, and in the back, is our numerous of the staff, and I'm not going to go around and introduce all of them, but you will meet them, all of them, if not, or most of them, if not all of them, in the coming weeks as we pour through the department budget. And I want to thank you for taking the time to learn this summer about DHSS. I know that it was painful from time to time. It was for us as well. So, but I think overall it was a great experience. We came out with a better understanding on our part as to necessary issues to be addressed, the urgency of the situation, and that the way we have done business in the past in the department is not adequate anymore, and we need to move forward and be more progressive. As you'll hear today in my presentation, I think we've made great steps toward that, and we'll continue to make steps. It is a work in progress, but we're moving quickly. What I'd like to do today is give you some highlights of our 15 budget requests. In addition, I'll be updating the committee on the projects to upgrade our Medicaid management information system and our eligibility computer systems. Then I will, a little bit on sequestration, what's happening with that, and Affordable Care Act, everybody seems to want to talk about that. And then finally, I'll discuss very briefly our steps moving forward with the 14 budget and some of the challenges that we have, and sum up and get out of the way. The first chart, first slide, is the organizational chart for the department. You see that there's quite a few changes from last year. You met most of the folks during the summer, but I'm going to run through them anyway. Craig Christensen, Deputy Commissioner, started, I believe, in February last year, so he was here for most of the process. He's learned what drinking out of fire hose is like, and so he's Deputy Commissioner and oversees primarily the Medicaid, Senior Disability Services, Pioneer Homes, and behavioral health aspects of it. Karen Forrest, brand new Acting Director of Juvenile Justice. Karen is here behind me. Barb Hengem has moved over for 90 days to manage Division of Behavioral Health, as Melissa Stone has moved on. And Melissa's out looking for her next adventure, and Barb has graciously agreed to step in, and Karen to step in DJJ to do that. And finally, a face you all recognize, Jason Hooley, has joined as a ledge liaison for the department. And he's back there somewhere behind me as well. Next slide. The summer meetings, it really was an opportunity to do a deep dive into the department budget. And they began in Anchorage with the Division of Public Health and Juvenile Justice. So we started out gently with you. And it was an opportunity for the Finance Committee to go deep in the budget and ask the questions that have kept you awake at night as the process went through last year. The process evolved with each meeting. I missed a meeting in Fairbanks, but I managed to make all the other meetings, and other priorities dragged me away from there. I spent part of the first day in the meeting, but it was an evolving process. We learned from each other. Representative Newman told me one of the highlights was the Fairbanks meeting with the OCS and public assistance staff. I'm sorry I had to miss that. It was a nice roundtable. Staff appreciated it. I think that was the learning process for all.
Commissioner, just on that point, for those who weren't familiar with that, what we'd asked is to, instead of just having a meeting in the conference room in the Fairbanks LIO, we asked to go to the offices Office of Children's Services and meet in their conference room with their staff, the people who do the work down there on the ground floor, the people with the mud on their boots and the dirt on their hands, you know, literally the ground bottom workers, the people who are really involved and engaged in the discussions. A very meaningful discussion back and forth to see exactly how they do their job, you know, and this is the route where we actually start touching the people that we affect with the budgets that we do, and it was a great discussion, and the feedback that I got from the members was that it was very informative. It was a good candid discussion. There was some maybe things said that the department felt uncomfortable with or we didn't, you know, then that's fine. That's what it was meant to do. as to trying to dig those out and root them up. And again, that's I want to try and take and mold these conversations into that style, you know, is into a different type of, again, away from a boilerplate type of a discussion that we have, is just open and candid discussions on how we're going to move forward. And I've got a few questions here that, have, you know, I've already let the commissioner know what we're going to be talking about here on one of them, and on future 10-year budgets from the governor's office and OMB and such. So we'll get into those. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Each year we publish, as required by the statute, the department annual report. I believe that most of you will have had the annual report delivered to your offices or in the process of having delivered them to your offices today and tomorrow. It's filled with the sort of information that was common in our presentations to the Finance Committee over the years. And it's just a compilation of here's where we are today. And it's easy reading, and I encourage you to take a look at it and see the breadth and scope of the department and what we do. If you're interested in knowing more about the divisions or directors and such, page through it, get to know it, and if you formulate some tough questions about it, I always appreciate it when I'm sitting behind the director watching that happen, so go for it if you would. There are, however, two charts that graphically display our 13 budget. The first one shows the allocation by type. Undesignated general fund through the federal is that those are the two big parts of the budget. Designated general fund is about 3%. Other funds, RSAs between departments and such, are an additional 3%. And a little more detail will be given on that a little later.
Mr. Chair, can you give us any idea of what do you see coming from the federal government? What patterns have you seen happening in D.C. and from the federal government coming out of there? And are you trying to project out finances that are going to be coming from the federal government? Give us your best guess on that.
Mr. Chairman, what we're seeing out of the federal government is pretty much status quo. I had expected that we would see reductions, as following sequestration, and I think that in some areas we're still going to see it. But we have seen some small increases in budget coming from the feds, and in terms of projecting forward, it's a dartboard. I really don't know where it's going to go. This current budget, the $1.1 trillion budget that was recently passed, I think is good through October or through September, and October it all starts all over again. How they're going to deal with other aspects of sequestration, what they're going to do about the defense budget, and, you know, have we found another war? So, you know, all those considerations have to be dealt with over the summer. And, you know, we're just going to stay hunkered down, Mr. Chairman, and move our budget in a conservative manner, because for every federal dollar I spend, I've got to find a state dollar to spend to accompany it. And even if additional federal dollars come available, we have to weigh against the availability of state dollars and the price of oil and how much is flowing through the pipeline. So
in the planning of a five-year budget, then, is it safe to say that we what I'm going to try and do is make the assumption of no growth on federal levels?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the wise course to take, no growth on federal. But once again, I have to say that for every dollar of federal money we have coming in, we roughly have to come up with a dollar of state money. So I don't see a lot of growth in state dollars coming either. And so the status quo is the direction that we're going. And how can we become more efficient at what we do?
Thank you. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, maybe I'm just confused by the nomenclature, because you keep using sequestration, and frankly, I don't know what they call what they're doing in Washington. So, but they did pass a budget, and all summer they were under a sequestered budget, and then now they've passed a budget. And so do the numbers that we're looking at now reflect the new budget numbers they've come up with rather than the sequestered budget numbers?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, they do.
Okay.
To the extent that we have them, certain public assistance program funding are subject to change. because they allocated a block amount of money. They haven't figured out how they're going to allocate it to individual states. That's left up to the departments within the federal government to apportion it out. So we haven't adjusted for that, but the budget that we have takes into account as much as we knew about where we were going with federal money.
Yeah, just to follow up, Mr. Chair, and I don't mean to start at the session with much disagreement, but there's an area that a lot of folks disagree with. I mean, a lot of this stuff is for every federal dollar, you have to match a state dollar, but for the Medicaid expansion, it's for every $9 we got from the feds, it's a dollar from the state. And we'll talk about that, I know, as the session goes along.
Representative Darrow, I'm sure we'll have many conversations about that, and my numbers are not quite as favorable as that, so thank you.
Okay.
We'll work on that one later.
Yep.
Commissioner?
This next set of slides represents the work that's progressed over the last year and a half to 2 years with our results-based budgeting. I know RBB, results-based budgeting, is a catchphrase. It's a sexy term to some folks, but honestly, it works. And results-based budgeting is a budget based on your outcomes, your outputs, and tie those together. It's been a priority of mine to get the department to look at the budget differently. The way we were looking at it before, it was a kind of a spend, baby, spend. And I use the analogy, when I worked in the private sector, and I worked for the Sisters of St. Joseph for almost 15 years, one of their phrases was, to do good, we have to do well. In other words, to be able to fulfill our mission, we have to be able to make money at it. I found the state government, as I've learned how to work in state government, is that to do well, we have to do good. And it's a flipping of the same phrase, but for us to be able to get the funding, we have to show that we're doing something with that funding and that we are accountable, that there's outputs and outcomes related to that. So for every dollar that we get, we have to show that there's a return to Alaskans. And that's the philosophy that I'm trying to bring forward, and you'll see that it is a department philosophy going forward on this. And we want to be able to present those numbers to you. Some of the numbers are going to be tedious, but a number that might be important to one of you might not be important to another, and another number might be important to another of you. So we're going to present the numbers. We're going to present them in a simple manner, and they're going to be tied to the department priorities. The department priorities are up here, that health and wellness across the lifespan, healthcare access, delivery, and value, cost, access, and quality. That's a phrase that's been out there for a long time with regards to healthcare. And then safe and responsible individuals, families, and communities. And each of those is broken down in a budget, and in the next following slides, as we go forward, I'll walk you through some of that. But I believe that we have to shift some of those priorities in terms of our current spending. Because if we're focusing on safe and responsible individuals, families, and communities, we're going to lose. We have to begin with the family. We have to begin with the village. And if we don't do that, we're going to continue to be on the treatment end of stuff, and where we're spending the majority of our money on treatment, much of which is avoidable. And so by creating strong family and community infrastructure, by working with communities and families to identify and address those needs, we're going to be better off. And that's the direction that I see us going, and hopefully that you want us to go.
So, Commissioner, I want to back up slide on that, actuals by division, pie chart.
One more. I'm sorry.
So we see public assistance at 13%. I mean, absence of Medicaid services, the rest of the division. Public assistance, large portion of that. We know that we've got a rapidly growing senior population in the state. Where within these divisions do you see more expanded growth in the 5 years? I mean, which of these divisions here do you see the largest potential for continued growth?
Mr. Chairman,
we can't control that. That's the one thing about the HESS budget. It's things happen out there.
Mr. Chairman, to attempt to address your question, it's so wide open. It's really hard for me to get at. I believe that we're going to see expanded growth in some way, in some means, in the Alaska Pioneer Homes. I believe we're going to see expanded growth in Medicaid services because it is such a behemoth that, and to be able to begin to change the way we deliver health care is going to take a bit of time. I often use with the Affordable Care Act that, you know, we're trying to legislate changing the way we pay for and deliver health care. We've got 100 years of doing it this way, the old way, and it's not something that you either legislate or turn the barge in the river quickly. It's going to be the same way with Medicaid services, that to begin to change that is going to take a little time. And so there's going to be continued growth in Medicaid services, back to the aging population, the silver tsunami, that I'll talk about it a little later. As we get older, it becomes more expensive. Our health care becomes more expensive. I read recently that last 7 years of our lives, 70% of the health care costs that we have happened in those last 7 years of life. So there's going to be something there. The Pioneer Homes, it's institutionalized in this state. It's something that people feverishly protect and support and look toward. And we have to figure out a better way to provide those services. And I say a better way to provide those services is, how do we grow the Pioneer Homes without breaking the bank?
Yeah, my concern, again, is just looking at this and trying to get an understanding of where we're going to see the expected growth in which divisions. Like, that's, we know Medicaid's going to be there. I'm trying to figure out in the next 5 years where we can expect it and where we've seen it. Representative Wilson, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. So what is your connection between your department and the Department of Education? Because what we saw this summer as we went around with our task force was teachers and principals talking about all the social issues that come into their classrooms and where that connection, because it seems like sometimes agencies are all kind of like in their own little silos. And if we don't start crossing over, you're right, say families come with better education, better community involvement. So how do I look at your budget and see how you are integrated with education, because the two of you are kind of combined?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's a tough question because we don't do enough. We've started to do it more and more with health-related portions of it. OCS involvement is sporadic in the schools. It isn't to the extent that it should be. The interplay between a classroom teacher and an OCS worker should be a normal activity, and that doesn't occur. Identifying kids that are going to encounter the juvenile justice system in one way or another, the earlier we identify them, the greater possibility we have to avert it. We have lots of opportunity. We haven't done enough. Neither department.
Thank you.
Thank you. I started earlier with an area of disagreement. I just want to thank the chair and the commissioner. I know your compassion for trying to make the system work is significant, so I appreciate that. I have just one area of possible cost savings and then one general question. We're talking about Medicaid, and we talked about this last year, and you said it wasn't as big as an issue as I thought it was, but I just keep hearing the anecdotal stories of people, youth, going to emergency rooms to deal with issues that can be dealt with at an urgent care, and if you live in a big city like Anchorage or Fairbanks. Could you change the Medicaid system to say, to let folks know they will not be covered for going to the emergency room. If there's a dock in the box, the state could pay to transport somebody to by cab. So we give a, we say, if you stay at the emergency room, we're going to garnish your permanent fund dividend. This is the kind of medical problem that can be dealt with down the block. We will pay for the cab fare. Is there a system like that that you would consider and that might save money? Or do you just not think the ill use of emergency room care for non-emergency issues is not an expensive issue for the state?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, when health care services comes up and the Medicaid chap comes up and does a presentation, you'll hear about a program to address high utilizers. And those are frequently the same folks who over-frequent emergency rooms. And that is their primary care center. Rather than going to their doc, I just go to the emergency room. I wait 20 minutes, and if I time it correctly in the day, I don't even have to wait 20 minutes. I'm in and I'm out, and I don't have to pay anything. There is a program that's being put in place to actively address and involve those people in wiser choices about this. It is a problem, and I don't recall that I said emergency room usage wasn't a problem in the state, but if I did, I apologize, because it is and it has been a problem. It's been something that we've been focusing on. But the more important thing is to engage our Medicaid recipients in their care. And you'll see that our patient-centered medical home projects, our primary care emphasis for primary care providers to become more engaged with their patients, because healthcare is a three-legged stool. It's the payer, it's the patient, it's the provider. And if all three aren't engaged, we're not going to have effective and efficient care. Long way of saying, we're working on it.
Thank you. Through the chair.
Yes. Commissioner, we always have to try and be cognizant of time management in the making sure we get through all of the material, so if we can, be careful on that. Representative Costello.
Oh, thank you, and I'll make this brief. Commissioner, thank you again for your time coming before the committee, and I wanted to follow up on Representative Wilson's idea of where your department and the Department of Education can be working smarter, and my question has to do with the school nurses. In my district, we have the Sand Lake Elementary School, where Jordis Clark, who's the nurse there, is seeing upwards of 70 children a day, and she has said that she is the primary care provider for those families. As we see the cost of schools rising astronomically every year, is there any way that that role can be paid for through Medicaid, perhaps, if in fact that position is servicing your clients that your department is in charge of overseeing?
Representative Costello, I'm just going to give you a short answer right now, but I think that we have not adequately developed, either on the deed side or on the Medicaid shop side, the ability to bill Medicaid for services delivered to Medicaid recipients in the school system.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we don't have page numbers, but I think where we're at. We'll do them next time.
Mr. Chairman, page numbers in the lower right-hand corner of the slide.
Oh, thank you. I didn't have one online.
Where am I?
Seven.
Total budget. I'm going to walk through different looks at the total budget and then at the very brief slide on the divisional budgets and how they fit to the priorities. But if you look at the total budget by priority right now, you see that 53% is on priority one, and it's health and wellness across lifespan. I think that we need to begin to shift some of that. It's still important, it's still necessary, but if we're going to change the way we deliver health care, we need to become more proactive, more toward the prevention side, and I think it begins with priority three, which is families and communities. And I've already said that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but we spend $1.4 billion on priority one, $447 million on two, and $735 million on priority three. And my goal is to begin to continue to shift those monies toward priority three, because I think it's it is the answer for us.
Looks like.
Primary service population. It's an interesting slide. I'm sorry I couldn't be more graphic and thing, but it shows the age distribution of our focus of dollars. And another shift that you're going to see is you're going to see more at the low end and more at the upper end. Because of the silver tsunami, as people like to talk about. Aging population, it's going to shift. No matter what we do, it's going to shift because as we get older, we use more services. On the low end, we need to do more to ensure that kids are healthy.
This is an interesting chart when you do this, but I just wanted to make sure this was clear that when you add the numbers up, it's more than the population of the state of Alaska, so obviously it indicates that some of these people are served multiple times. What types of where are we seeing them served at? What's happening when they're being served? What's going on there?
Can you give me another hint, Mr. Chairman?
we see that they're being served. What does being served mean? I mean, what is happening?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, it's the entire gamut of what we do in the department. So the services that are being offered, the low end of the scale, the children, baby visits, immunizations, taking care of high-risk babies. It's just a broad spectrum.
So in the children served like that, which ones do you see multiple times coming back over? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Hopefully we see children multiple times, period. Because the more we see a child, the better off we are. And it's going to decrease through the middle ranges, but because the larger part of the population is in the middle ranges, the number of visits is going to be down. And then with the senior population, that number is going to continue to climb as the population ages. I probably haven't answered your question, but...
I have a fairly good idea myself. I'm trying to get more information to other members. So,
would you like to share that, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I continue. Like you said, you continue to see it with the services to children. You know, with OCS and those types of programs, where your personnel are out there trying to make contact with these children in need throughout the state multiple times, but there's still not enough of it happening, and that's. How do we get that and prioritize that? It starts at that kid. If we can get that kid, that child, and get their life, help them get their life in order and get a better understanding at that point, it helps the rest of their life. And it's what you've been saying all along here this morning. Catch them before they fall into the river, instead of dragging them out. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With what you just said. I was just curious, since we're looking at this number, as the chairman pointed out, this is obviously includes duplicates, people who are they're counted if they see different branches. Do you have a sort of a non-duplicated number of how many Alaskans are served by your department?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, I believe that we can get close with that. But last year, you may recall, I was looking at developing the Master Client Index. It's still a work in progress. It's an IT system. It seems that they are always works in progress. But that will give us that, be able to give us that unduplicated count. But
I know with different databases, it's not as easy as it sounds, so I will.
Thank you. Krista?
Next slide. As I promised, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one, but we took that budget by priorities and we broke it down by divisions and how the division relates to the individual priorities. And as they go through their reports, they will talk to you about what they're doing in each division to address the three priorities and how that number adds up. And you see it varies by division. It's going to be an interesting process as this further evolves, because the evolution is going to be able to give you not only the outputs, but the outcomes of that as well. In other words, are we doing good? And if we are, what are we doing? Now we get to the meat. If you look at our budget and the small amount of growth, I'm going to go right to the gray shaded line. Our 14 budget management plan was $2,665,000,009. Our 15 request is $2,669,500,000,000. I can't do much better than that. And if you want me to do better than that, I'll be bleeding, but happy to discuss it with you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, you know, this body did good in working with the management plan and what we actually, the requests were and getting to the management plan and now the new governor's request. And the bottom line is, you know, the commissioner and every one of us are so aware of is we have declining revenue funds. And where do you target those funds at? And that's again, are going to be our goal is to hit the highest priority. I'm glad that you kind of submitted this proposal in priority-wise. You know, and how much money you spend in each division and prioritizing the value of that dollar. But it's still going to be a struggle. You know, we still have other things that we have to cover. We have to cover education and public safety and all these other issues in the state that are constitutionally required also. So this is never an easy one because it's touched people's lives. And it's a difficult decision. But, again, we're going to try and we're going to be doing our best. And we're going to look at every dollar. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Commissioner, and you know, and I know you have private sector experience that is valuable here. But the one thing that concerns me about the proposal, which is to go from basically last year's budget and continue the budget at basically the exact same number this year, is in the governor's announcement. He said he expects salary increases to be covered inside the new budget. Which means if in the same number you have more salary, you're going to have less money for the services that those people who are getting the bigger salaries provide. And I have no doubt that you'll be able to find stuff within the department that is less important, but can you allay my concerns that by funding increased salaries with the same number as last year's budget number, we're not going to start cutting programs that actually make a difference in people's lives?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, no. I can't guarantee that to you. Along with reduced budget numbers, I have 29 less positions again this year. And I don't know if you've been keeping track, but it was 58 2 years ago that I went down. It's another 29 this year. And it's largely based on vacancies that we had, and that's where we're getting some of the money to cover things. But it's going to be a tough road to hoe. I have taken all the folkways and mores off the table and said everything has to be vulnerable to move the department forward. And, you know, we've got to figure out better ways to spend what we do. I have some priority programs that I want to move forward in the department. And, you know, I've already given you hints about this, stronger families and communities. And to do that, I have to find places within our existing budget to be able to fund those programs. And other, we are constantly looking at our current vacancy rate. You know, where have we got long-term vacancies that we can move? Why do we have a long-term vacancy where it is? Where can we reclassify positions to fund some of the studies that have been done in the past throughout the department? And it's a constantly evolving and working process. And, you know, I'm hoping to be able to have the latitude either through amended or supplemental to address some of that.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could you tell us on the $8.4 million that's increased, is that federal, are we backfilling? Or is that new programs? You know, where is that increase going to be seen in the budget?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I was skipping over that one. It's basically the Medicaid, increased Medicaid costs. And we have to come up with roughly 40-odd percent of the offset to the federal. So it's not decreased federal funding. It's the increased costs in Medicaid. And we have basically funded, because you see the budget, we basically funded increased Medicaid costs on the back of the rest of the department.
Follow-up, sir?
Representative Wilson.
So is that because we have more in the Medicaid program, or is it just as the program has been changing that we have a bigger share? I'm just trying to figure out, is it an increase of people that are coming into the system, or just the system itself is growing because of cost?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the short answer is yes. We have an increasing number of people coming into the program. Costs continue to go up in the program on an individual service level basis, utilization. And when you receive the Medicaid budget report, you'll see a lot of the activities that are occurring to offset that.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I'd like to represent, welcome Representative Gutberg.
Thank you.
Commissioner, this is as good a time as any to ask this question. You know, we're looking at a summary that was presented by the governor's OMB, Office of Management and Budget. And it states in there on a 10-year plan that the FY15, the state's portion of the federal Medicaid program, was about $700 million, just under $700 million. Over the next 10 years, that figure is projected to increase at an annual rate of over 7.2%. So by 2014, it's projected to require a $1.3 billion contribution from the state's general fund. That's what we're looking at in 10 years. How can we keep general fund spending at $5.6 billion, which is the governor's target, over the next 10 years and account for a $600 million projected increase in Medicaid?
Representative Newman, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to find the words to be able to express this, but I don't buy those numbers.
I don't either.
And Santa and I were talking earlier about those exact numbers, and that I think the 7.2 average is excessive, particularly based on the last few years. I would like an opportunity in the process of this year's legislative session to show you through the five-year lookout, as you, five-year plan, the difference that I believe where the budget is going. They're going to be here unless we change the way we do business. There's going to be something between the 7.2 that Ledge Finance gave you and the four range that I think we're much closer to. So if I can have the opportunity over the course of the next 88 days to talk to you about that and bring it back to the committee, I'd like to have the opportunity to do that.
87 days.
Mr. Chairman, I stand corrected.
We want an 89-day session this year. You know, that just goes again, we can talk about, I don't want to emphasize just what we're dealing with here. We can talk about gas pipelines, we can talk about oil prices and such, but this is something that's already in our lap. This is something that the ball is rolling. That train's running full steam, and how do we capture this in our operating budget? This is going to overwhelm every other operating budget that we have to try and deal with if we don't come up with some imaginative solutions. I do have a half a dozen or so proposals I'll be presenting to the committee on how we can change things. We're working with the Health Commission and Dr. Hobart and Debbie Erickson over there, and we're going to be hearing from them on some of these proposals. So I've been working with the commissioner. He's very well aware of where we're going on some of these proposals, and he's aware of what we're doing there. Jeff Jesse over at Mental Health Trust is helping us on some problems, and he's going to be working in a combined effort with us. So I've reached out to not just the department, but again, the Mental Health Trust and the Health Commission to assist us to try and get to where we need to do that. And so we've got some proposals put forward and discussions that I've had with them and their expertise that they bring to the table in a combined effort. You know, we're all in this together. We're all in this together. And so we'll be bringing those, we'll be laying those out here shortly and open those up for discussion. I think some pretty exciting stuff and some changes there, and I'm excited about that. So We're looking at, again, a very low growth and a $2.7 billion budget, of, you know, increase of $8.4 million. And last year we hit the commissioner pretty hard. We did that. That was difficult, trying to do those in one-time cuts. And we all go through that with our own budgets and each year and trying to reduce that. My goal over the next 5 years is to reduce the cost of health care in Alaska overall. This is how we will reduce the operating budget for health and social services in the long run. Reduce those front-end costs, what it costs the state to deliver those services. And at the same time, we're going to be assisting industry and businesses in the state, you know, as we do that, and every individual Alaskan who has, you know, so that's our goal. In a nutshell, you know, and that's where we're headed to, so that's where I kind of be presenting some of that. And again, it's, we can sit there and look at this commissioner's budget and whack out a few million here and there every year. It's very difficult to do, and because it does affect people's lives, but I think overall delivering health care costs to all Alaskans on the front end is the way we're going to do long-term sustainable budgets.
Mr. Chairman, this next slide, I put it in here to show you what we need to change, because our 2005 authorized budget, look at the percent of total funds in 2005, 72, 7, 14, 2, 5. 2015, 73, 6, 14, 2, 5. We are virtually unchanged from 2005 in our budget. And that's some of the stuff that I think that's low-hanging fruit, that we have to identify the low-hanging fruit to be able to bend the curve, continue to bend the curve, to flatten the curve, to be able to maintain. I fully understand we have to do more with less. Understand it, and Representative Garrett talked about my private sector experience. If we didn't have increasing revenue, I didn't have an increased budget. It just didn't work, and I'm trying to do the same thing here. And I think that you've seen that in the last, now my third year of submitting some pretty lean budgets moving forward. And so I say, you know, whack away, but whack with us, not at us, if we could ask for that.
I think we have.
Representative Costello.
Oh, thank you. Commissioner, do we have any idea how much we could possibly save if the clients that are eligible for Indian Health Service reimbursement of 100% were actually served in that environment versus the state?
Representative Costello, just a number off the top of my head is $200 million.
Thank you.
That's a lot of money.
Mr. Chairman, that's a lot of money. Right now, about 40% of the health care that is delivered to Alaska Natives and Native Americans is delivered in the Native health system. And if I could take that to 80%, I would be very pleased. Some of it's never going to. Certain specialty services where it's not efficient for them to deliver the services, pediatric cardiology, some neurology services, very complex medical services, we'll never be able to move over, but we're looking at everything that we can. We're in negotiations right now with CMS to pay for more services at 100% that are delivered. For instance, when the, let's say that the tribal community, the Indian Health Services in the state of Alaska acquire Medevac services. Getting Medevac services, right now they're paid at 50% regardless of whether it's tribal or not. And so if I can encourage them to allow Medevac services to be covered, if it's a tribally owned Medevac service at 100%, I save a lot of money and just in that area, because most of our medevacs are from the bush, and most of our residents in the bush are tribal members. So.
And that's probably an ongoing discussion, Representative Costello, and we'll bring that up for, you know, one of our meetings and what we're doing in there. I know that the commissioner's working on getting some, working with the Tanana Chiefs, TCC, to get some money over there so that they can maybe do work a little more efficiently than what the state's doing and more directly, particularly in the Fairbanks area where they've had some issues up there. So he is reacting to that, you know, and trying to come up with some solutions to that. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm not going to ask questions about the formula of the grants. That's fine. Well, it's not fine, but the things that I think that can make additions, I'm looking at slide 11, going back one. But the administration and the facilities cost increases, how do they compare across the other agencies? Are they comparable? Is this what we're looking at DOT, fuel costs, salary increases? Is this what it is for DOT, for DNR, for admin, for the others?
Representative Guttenberg, to the chair, I'm going to start out by saying I have no idea, and then I'm going to say that DHSS is probably the closest in terms of funding to transportation because of the bulk of federal money mm-hmm. that's in there. Transportation, I think, has a larger percentage of federal money than we do and a much smaller percentage of state funding. We're pretty well split, and so I don't think you'll find another department that's comparable to us in terms of revenue sources in particular.
Well, no, I'm just talking about internal management of the department as far as how efficient you are, the administrative costs of things, your facilities costs. Do you have older, inefficient buildings, or do you have more efficient, cost-effective buildings? Questions like that.
Representative Guttenberg, through here, I can't answer that.
Okay.
I can't answer half the questions about my own department. Huh. So.
Representative Garrett Thompson and
Just on Representative Costello's question on Indian Health Service funding and whether we could shift more that way, just my understanding and reading is that they're allotted a certain amount of money and they run out. And it's not like there's an inexhaustible amount of money for every patient who would qualify. And my understanding that that's a federal issue, that's all federally funded. So how would you have... Without getting more money from Congress, is it not impossible to shift more money to the Indian Health Service where you get 100% reimbursement?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, that's incorrect. With Medicaid is the entitlement program.
Right.
And so that's kind of an open tap. Mm-hmm. What the Alaska Native Health Facilities, ANTHC, and others talk about is the money from IHS that is apart from Medicaid, apart from state general fund that they may receive for a facility or something like that. It's the straight IHS funds that they receive. I believe it's $606 million that they receive for Indian Health Services. On top of that, I want to say they received about $260 million, and don't quote me on that at this point. I'll get it for you, in Medicaid funding. The more people that they enroll in Medicaid, the more people that they provide services to in Medicaid, that's the more Medicaid revenue that they receive from us and the more saving that we have in terms of general fund dollars. Because if a tribal member receives services in a non-Native facility, we pay 50% of the Medicaid bill. If they receive it in a tribal facility, we get 100% reimbursement from the feds for that same service.
That money doesn't run out?
Does not run out.
Okay, thanks.
Well, Representative Garrett, through the chair,
hopefully.
So far it hasn't run out. They seem to have an open tap for most things. So.
They keep printing it. Representative Thompson?
No, I didn't.
Representative Munoz?
Thank you. First of all, thank you, Chairman, for your work over the interim, and also to the Commissioner and all of the staff that worked diligently over the interim with us. I really appreciate your work. My question is on the wide variety of the cost of services, medical services in Alaska as we compare to other states. Does Medicaid have a published rate of services, or are we subject to this wide range of costs within our state? and can we benefit if we did have a published rate of services?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, for most medical services, we have our own rate that we pay. For physician services, it's largely based on a percentage above Medicare. To show you where we fit in the national scheme, the average reimbursement in Medicaid across the nation is about 67% of Medicare. So they're basically 67 cents of every dollar that Medicaid pays for. We pay about 140% of Medicare. We're a generous payer. Most providers participate with us. There are certain specialties, certain services that it's lower percentages, but if you look at primary care, if you look at specialty care, most participate with Medicaid because it is a desirable rate. So in that sense, we follow private insurance, private charge, in terms of paying considerably above most states.
Can I follow up? Do we have opportunities really to tighten up our budget in that area of reimbursement as an opportunity to really to look for savings considering the high rate of reimbursement?
Representative Munoz, I'm going to apologize for this being a bit of a smart alecky answer, but it's an election year, and I'm probably not going to be addressing tightening up the rates, but I think that in areas we do have opportunities for savings. I think the greatest opportunity for savings is driving care back into the hands of the primary care physician, so that primary care provider, I misspoke, because it needs to begin there. That's where prevention occurs. That's where wellness occurs. That's where babies get their shots. And the more folks we can drive back to the primary care physician, I think the greater savings we're going to have. And I think that's where rather than cutting rates, if we can change the ideology, the mentality that, I go where I want, get what I want, get out of the emergency rooms, get into the hands of the primary care physician, making sure that the child is getting their allergy medication, making sure that the senior is taking their heart medications, those kinds of things.
Thank you.
The next slide is just, I know you guys like pie charts, so we put the last two slides in a pie chart so you can see. And next slide. Santa will take over.
Basically, the next two slides are the slides prepared by Ledge Finance to show and highlight. Thank you.
For the record.
Oh, for the record, my name is Santa Eford. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Finance and Management Services for the department.
Thanks, Santa.
As I said, page 13 and 14, the next two slides are the graphs that are prepared by Ledge Finance. The first one is our total GF growth over the past 10 years. And as you'll see in this graph, you'll see the bar graphs, the purple graphs show there was a period in time that GF dipped, 2009, 2010, 11. That period was the time when the state was experiencing an enhanced FMAP for the Medicaid services. Throughout the country, there was an enhanced FMAP, and then our GF grew when that FMAP has now changed and balanced back out to basically 50%. So GF shifted and increased there.
Anna, one thing I'm going to highlight in here is in the block there, one of the bullet points talks about the department's total FY14 general fund budget equates to about $4,000 per resident worker. Some of the numbers that tend to jump out at me as we've gone through these discussions, I was talking to one of the healthcare professionals, I believe they stated that there's about $7 billion a year is what is spent in healthcare in the state of Alaska on 700,000 people. Do the numbers. I think Commissioner here a couple weeks ago, we were talking about pharmaceuticals. $1 million a week, the state's costs on pharmaceuticals. $1 million a week. you know, these are numbers that are staggering when you start putting these together, and you each all have your individual budgets and you know what they are. But this is what we're talking about here and how these numbers can add up pretty fast. Senator?
On that same point.
President Butler?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that same bullet, the number per resident worker. I mean, I understand you're dividing off between non-resident worker and traveler, you know, people that the seasonal worker. Why did you? What's the difference if you didn't divide that out? And where's the state's responsibility in there? And what would the graph look like if all workers in the state were included?
I would have to defer to Ledge Finance. This is their information,
okay,
and the way the numbers were determined by the number of workers.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll help you with that data.
The next slide is a picture of total funds, all funds, and the relationship. The top color in the bar graph being federal funds, the next portion, other funds, designated general funds, and the unrestricted general funds. And it just shows the comparison and the change in those over the past 10 years.
All right. The next updates that I would like to be able to give the group is kind of overviews of some activity that is going on within the department and some of the challenges that we have related to it. The MMIS system upgrade, I was hoping to have a Xerox representative here. He flew all day yesterday from Florida, made it as far as Ketchikan. He's been enjoying the sights of Ketchikan ever since, and was hoping to fly in about 9:30 today, and as I look out, and I'm not hopeful that he's going to arrive. One of the things that if he is able to get here today and you would like to be able to speak with him, please let Josh Appleby or I know, and we'll schedule an appointment, because I really think a lot of what he has to say is important. I take full responsibility for what happened with the MMIS upgrade, or what didn't happen with the MMIS upgrade. It was on my watch. I signed the original contract with ACS back in 2007. ACS was bought by Xerox in 2012, so they're now Xerox. There's been challenges with the system. But the challenges that we are experiencing with the system, although painful, we are doing everything we can to mitigate. We paid out millions of dollars in advances to providers to offset cash flow issues that they may have. Certain groups have been hit harder than others. Certain residential facilities have been hit harder. The dental providers have been hit probably the hardest in terms of the professional side. And we are working with them and for them in every way that we can to mitigate damage. I know Misery doesn't always love company, but Oregon went almost 7 months and without making payments. Idaho went a similar length of time, and Maine went almost a year just operating, providing advances. These are complicated systems with millions of lines of programming, and it should have worked. That's bottom line, it should have worked. It will work, but we will continue to get in front of providers, to be with providers, to ease in any way that we can the challenges that they're having. Providers have been reluctant to take advances, and we're trying to encourage them to be a little more willing to take advances. They're worried about being able to track against a claim. It's a once again, when I was in the private sector, I never would have taken an advance for that exact reason. So I understand. But the fact that it's 3 months out and some providers are at 50% of what they build, cash flow begins to result. And so we're working with them to ease their fears about being able to track the system and move it forward.
Mr. on that, Representative Higgins it's been working on that issue quite a bit. It's going to hope to have some discussions on that this afternoon. Representative, can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in Hess this afternoon for people who want more information on this?
Well, we're going to be having a meeting with the commissioner and Xerox with us, and then we're planning on the first week of February to have an open hearing so that everyone knows. And again, the providers in the state can call in and actually ask Xerox questions and whatnot. But by that point, though, the commissioner has, I don't want to say guaranteed me, but has alluded that we'll have about 99% of our issues resolved. And we're working towards that, you know, and we're all working towards this together. And I've got, you know, emails and letters on my desk about people that are having problems with this program. I'm disappointed in this program. Especially the rollout obviously didn't go as planned. And so, you know, we do have to fix it, and we are. And the commissioner's working hard on it, and I appreciate your work on that. So but transparency is the most utmost importance at this point in the game. And people are frustrated, and I'm pretty sure you're aware of that at this point. So if anybody wants to get a hold of my office for more details on that, we'll do it. We're going to work that out this afternoon. More on the hearing date and what we want to do. Okay?
Thank you, Representative Higgins. And, Commissioner, can you just briefly talk about how Medicaid reimbursement payments by the department to health care providers around the state, how that's going? If people need their back payments, can you kind of just briefly give us a little short discussion on that? What should health care providers be doing?
Mr. Chairman, healthcare providers, what are they doing? They continue to billing. We continue to try to communicate with them on a regular basis. Payments are going up. Prior to the new system going live, the average weekly payment was $27 million. So you spend $27 million a week on Medicaid. In October, the average payment after system go live was around $14 million a week. So that's about 50%. In November, it was $17.7 million a week average. In December, it was $18.9 million a week. In January, the first payment was around $22 million. The last payment was $33 million. So things are getting better. We're catching up. We're not caught up. We continue. That's why I continue to push the advances to those providers that are most effective. You know, and Representative Higgins is one of those that feels the most pain, and in that respect, hospital payments probably the group that can most absorb cash flow issues are going much better, and certain groups right out of the door they did well. Ophthalmology, optometry is also having some challenges, but it's pocketed, so we need to address that.
Thank you, Commissioner. We're going to delve into this one at length, and so we'll have more questions then. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I have a physician who I don't know, but who actually Facebooked me instead of emailed me. But so now I have to check my Facebook account. He serves roughly 50% a Medicaid clientele, and he keeps telling me he's going to go belly up. He's so many months behind in his payments. And so are these people we can work with your department on, or do you just have too much work for us to try and work those things out?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, by all means, work with the department on. You can talk to me directly. You could talk to Deputy Commissioner Christensen or Director Margaret Brody on the Medicaid side. We will contact the provider, as we've been doing, and talk to them about, do you want to advance? We will look at their billings. We will look at everything that they interact with us on. Nobody should be going belly up because we have made the advances available.
Thanks.
Representative Higgins?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. You know, one of the concerns that all the providers have, and we talked a little bit about this already, but maybe if you can, for people that are watching and the providers that are watching gavel to gavel, because I think this is going to be aired on it, as far as timely filing, because that's a big concern for a lot of providers on what they're having. And I've had a lot of people call me and ask me what I should do, and I've told them, you know what, refile it, because I always like the paper trail, because it always helps. And they're told from the department, don't refile it. We're trying to catch up. Don't do that. And so I'm telling them something different than what we're doing. So if you can kind of talk a little bit about that so it can put the providers at ease on this timely filing, because that's an important issue that a lot of us are having right now. So if you can just maybe...
Representative Higgins, through the chair, some would say that you're our worst nightmare by refiling. That's, at this point, I do not believe that reposting a claim is the way to do it. We are 3 months out. We have a year for timely filing. I have no problems overriding timely filing for something like this. And Margaret is here in the back. We'll talk afterward with you. But if she says that she's going to stick to timely filing, I think she's still under me in the chain of command, so we will discuss it further. No, seriously, timely filing will not be an issue with regards to the Medicaid claiming process.
Good. That's what people want to hear.
Ness, you know, I'm just going to wrap this one up in saying that I think the department did what they needed to do to try and upgrade their IT systems and their internet technology systems, their electronic systems, to upgrade that to make it faster, more efficient, more accountability on the state's funds. They bought into a program that was supposed to be one of the best in the nation, the state-of-the-art program. And when it rolled out after 3 years of working to get it implemented, it didn't work. But they're the ones who are taking the brunt on why it didn't work. To me, it falls back on Xerox, and we're going to hear from them. But they're the ones who have to deal with it. They're the ones who have to deal with our providers every day, but they were doing what they're supposed to do in upgrading our system after 25 years to get it to where it needed to be. They were in all good conscience doing the best that they could, and they bought a system that rolled out that didn't work. I mean, we hear about Obamacare, and that rolled out, and it didn't work. This is not much different, in my opinion. My concern is Margaret Brody's over here trying to deal with Representative Higgins and all the other healthcare providers out there and spending her time doing that instead of helping as a director for the people over at OCS and other people within the personnel within her department. She's spending her time trying to fix these problems instead of doing her job. That's the problem that I'm having. So how do I sit there and us as a department or the legislature cover their personnel costs trying to fix Xerox's problem instead of their doing their jobs helping Alaskans and every other area that need to be helped? That's where I start having problems and how we're going to go back on that. So I'll wrap it up with that before I get too wound up. But the commissioner's getting booted a lot on this. He was doing his job. They rolled out. They bought into a system. It didn't work. They're doing their best to get it fixed. Commissioner.
Thank you for that, Representative Newman. It is on my watch. It is us. Margaret and Craig and I, get all that overtime that you so graciously pay us for doing this. And
their salary, so.
It will work. We will make it work. It is state of the art.
We'll hear more about it. We're just going to have to get the people here from Xerox, and we'll talk about it then.
We also, last year I talked about Perfect Storm, that we're bringing up a new EIS system as well. I'm happy to report that it's moving along. It was delayed a month or so, but it is moving along. It's moving along well. And that the self-service portal is up and operating. People are actually enrolling on the self-service portal in the new system. The worker portal is coming up, I believe, the second week in February. And so the workers will be able to go online and use the new system, too. Then we will begin the second part of it, which is the rest of the public assistance programs. This is the good thing about this system is it's operating in, I believe, 27 other states. So this is a proven system. With the Medicaid Management Information System, it was a new system. We're the second state to bring it up. New Hampshire was the first state. North Dakota is right behind us. New Hampshire is daily functioning better and better and better. And they had some of the early challenges that we had, but in a different scale, different scope. So it's it is what it is. So with that, I'll stop on that. But the ARIES system is what the new EIS system is called. And that one will have updates for you throughout session because it daily the different
components. Maybe you can bring an example or display it, and we can see it in motion. Is there a way to do that?
Mr. Chairman, we can try to do that. Sequestration, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of, we're running out of time, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot on that. But as you know, the $1.1 trillion spending bill has gone forward. Under the budget deal, somebody asked about, you know, what's the crystal ball? LIHEAP, the heating assistance program, nationally, we received $3.4 billion in funding. It's $169 million more than previous. So we will get, you know, our small portion of that. There'll be many less decimal points, but it will help the program and help the folks in heating assistance. The senior nutrition program, which funds Meals on Wheels, gets $815 million. That's $46 million more than they got last year. And in the face of last year's cuts, nearly 70% of Meals on Wheels programs reduce the number of meals they served. And across the nation, that meant cutting 364 meals per week. And I got to spend the summer at visiting some of the senior facilities and things and saw the impact of Meals on Wheels and the in-home dining programs that were in place. And it made a believer out of me, maybe because I'm getting to that age where it starts to look good. But it does. And, you know, saw how people benefited from having them delivered to them. But
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gutberg.
I think that on the Meals on Wheels, with the cuts in meals served, have you seen a comparable shift of costs? For me, this is one of those things where it creates a deferred cost. You give somebody a meal, they get nutrition, they get hydrated, all those things that come along with it. It keeps them out of other problems down the road. You know, in the end, emergency room visits, doctor visits, EMS calls, things like that, family stress, all those other things. Is this something that's trackable for rises in that community for hospital visits or increased costs?
Representative Guttenberg, to the chair, it's more anecdotal than it is that we can show a clear linkage between the two. But one example I can give is a Meals on Wheels driver in one of our communities was delivering a meal to an elderly lady, and she had suffered a fall. And he knocked on the door. She didn't answer the door. And he finally heard her yelling, and he went inside. And I have little doubt because of her medical condition by the time she got to the hospital that she would have expired. And there are examples of that we hear frequently, but to take that all together and put some empirical number around it, I can't do that.
And obviously the health and welfare checks is a large part of that. A lot of the communities I know in the MATSU have joined together instead of the different senior centers, each doing their own Meals on Wheels programs now. They've combined that to reduce administrative costs and get more money on the street or be more efficient that way. I know in the past several years, Senator Huggins and I have used what capital funds we could get to improve their kitchens. And I know that many of you have done that to help your senior centers do that so they can provide those meals more efficiently and better dishwashers and septic. I mean, there's a lot of things that can go into doing that. So, you know, I know that we've all helped our senior centers do that to help our seniors in that way. But it's a collective thing, and it goes back to communities helping the communities grow and being more efficient that way, too. And that's a large part of what we're doing.
Final thing, somebody brought up earlier, I think it was Representative Garrett brought up that, you know, we passed a budget, therefore, where sequestration play into this? Sequestration is still there. About 80% of the cuts that were delivered under sequestration were eliminated in this budget cycle. But it's still on the books. And in 2 years, when this budget cycle is gone, sequestration is live and well. So we still have 14% of the cuts that are in effect, but the sequestration, since it's still on the books, will be back, you know, unless there's a big turnaround in the federal economy in the next year and a half, which I'm not the most optimistic about. Final thing, Affordable Care Act. I just want to talk very briefly about it. Where are we with it? As you know, we didn't do a Medicaid expansion. And when we look at the number of folks enrolling on the federal exchange, about 3,000 people selected market place plans before December 28, and 83% of those qualified for federal subsidy. So that's a lot. That's a high percentage, and that was one of the concerns about, are we going to have the cash to be able to do this?
And that's probably something that we're going to delve into some further discussion. It's been a big issue in the state. It's my understanding the governor's office now has hired a new advisor on health policy, a specialist on health policy. Maybe we can have her come and advise us on what the governor's thoughts are on this and what they plan on doing to do this in the future. Commissioner's working on a commission, a specialist to look at this and to see what we can do to provide health care to uninsured Alaskans in the state, people who need additional services. So there's several things that are going on right now. So again, I'd like to hear from the governor's office and the administration, from his advisors on this. We'll hear from the commissioner further on it, and further reports from the health commission and a new group that is going to be put together again to look at uninsured Alaskans. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you said about 3,000 people had enrolled, and I think you said in private plans. What have we seen in the way of new Medicaid enrollment as a result of the Affordable Care? Has that gone up?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, we've seen about 1,100, I believe, is the last number that I saw that are coming across through the federal exchange. We're not seeing significant increases in people enrolling in Medicaid because they're newly eligible yet. But the 1,100 that we have coming across from the federal exchange are coming across in a flat file. Flat file is basically an Excel spreadsheet, a little more than an Excel spreadsheet. And they have not automated the Medicaid portion of the federal exchange. So it's coming across almost manually. And we're checking those, we're enrolling those when we can, but there's a lot of missing data, a lot of information that we don't have yet. So I think it's going to be March before we're really going to see any impact on increased Medicaid enrollment, either through Woodwork or newly eligibles. Okay. Does that help?
That does. Thank you.
Thank you.
President Garrett? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might miss Monday's hearing on Medicaid. And I just certainly am. There's no doubt, even with federal reimbursement at 90% 2 years from now, that it'll cost the state some money to take on the Affordable Care Act, and then it's a judgment for everybody to make as a matter of policy. But can you get us an estimate? If there are different levels of who qualifies for Medicaid today, but let's just say a lot of people qualify up to the 75% level of poverty. The Affordable Care Act would have covered you up to 133% of poverty. By not accepting that, we not only are not providing Medicaid to those folks, but they don't get the private subsidies because of the way the lawsuit worked against the Affordable Care Act. So no Medicaid, no private subsidies for people between roughly 75% and 133%. if we, can you give us a, what cost savings we might generate if we did join so that folks did get coverage up to 133%? Those folks would be less likely to put their kids on Denali Kid Care, where the state has to pay roughly 40%. So could you try and give your best guess as to, at least, I know there are some things that will cost the state more, but wouldn't we save money on Denali Kid Care because we would be providing insurance to people and the right to get Medicaid that way, that we'd get 90% reimbursement instead of 40% reimbursement for those kids.
Representative Garrett, through the chair.
Commissioner, if we can, I'd like to spend some more time on the Affordable Care Act and implementation of that. So if we can, you know, get to that, hold that question, or if you can briefly give him a short answer on that, but there's a lot longer answer to what he's asking. You know, I'd like to give our opportunity for, we've got legislators from rural Alaska who maybe had organizations who would wanted to see that implemented, maybe an opportunity to hear from their people too, or how that goes, because it's a big discussion in the state of Alaska, and there's a lot of numbers out there, and it has to deal with a huge amount of our economy. So if you can give them a short answer on this, but
Mr. Chairman,
we'll be looking at this further. If members have specific questions, please get them to us, and we'll get them to the commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, I can give a short answer. Representative Garrett, through the chair. First of all, those between 100 and 133% of poverty level are eligible for the exchange. They're eligible to enroll, they're eligible for subsidies, and in most cases, they're going to be eligible for 100% subsidy. Those below 100% of poverty level, largely childless adults, are not eligible for the exchange and not eligible for Medicaid, and those are the folks in the gap. And those are the folks that I've been asked to focus on for the governor for supplemental budget to be able to identify gap coverage for them in some way. Denali Kid Care. Denali Kid Care, it's a mixed bag. Only those on Denali Kid Care up to 133% of poverty level would be eligible for the exchange. Those between 133 and the current 175, which with modified adjusted gross income is going to be going up to close to 200, if not slightly above, they will not be eligible under Medicaid expansion. So it's a small number, and it's a small savings for the exposure. I think it's something that, you know, can be looked at, but it's a bit of a card game. That help?
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes, since it's 10 o'clock, that concludes my report.
So that kind of basically your budget allocation authorities. We allowed you to move a little bit of money around to cover shortstops, and realizing that we do have deficits coming. We had sequestration. We didn't know how that was going to affect the department, so in an effort to try and allow the department to fill some of those gaps, I don't think they used any of that money, but they had. We wanted them to allow them to do that, so we made sure that Alaskans did have coverage where they needed it. Representative Wilson.
So, Commissioner, and I appreciate everything you've done this summer, and I know you guys have done a lot of work, and so has our chair for this, but we know that we can only make so many cuts because it does affect every family that it does. So in reality, I guess it's just back to that connection between our different departments, because really, if we want to cut this department in, besides financially what people get, is it not really based on how many graduates we have out of high school, what our labor force is, and whether or not they're getting the kind of training to go into jobs? Because that's really the, I mean, we have a disabled group who won't be able to do but certain types of jobs. But don't we have a pretty big group in there that through educational opportunities or just, you know, maybe getting kind of dropped through the cracks really should be some of our biggest targets? Because if they go back to work, we do take our children off of Denali Kid Care. We're not having them on Medicaid. They're not doing public assistance because they're working now. And so since I have the labor budget and education budget, it just seems like how we do those two budgets with yours could have the biggest impact or decrease in your budget more than anything else. So, and you don't need to give me an answer now because I know it's kind of a loaded question. How do we better work within the system to get those services around the group that you're serving? And how can we better assist, you know, you in doing that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I look at nearly every other department, and there ought to be a better link than what we have. I look at corrections. I look at public safety. I look at education. I look at transportation and labor. We ought to be working better together. How can you assist? By telling us to do it. But after I say that, Representative Wilson, after I say that, I can't take on much more.
And, Mr. Chair, in all seriousness, though, and I do understand that, I think we are in silos, and that really is our biggest problem, is even as we do our budgets, each one of us has, you know, several budgets that we look at that budget, then we look at this budget, but they're all intertwined. I mean, the commissioner could only make so many cuts before there's going to be so much screaming and yelling that because people have to have money to live off of. And so, you know, it's not just, I don't think, about us telling you what to do, which we like to do anyway, but is how do we, you know, start integrating these, because they're not silos. One has everything to do with each other. If we don't do a good job in education, the correction budget sees it, or the public safety budget sees it. And I just, you know, since I've been here, I haven't seen how we get everybody together. Maybe, and I think I might start just in mine, is having different commissioners, even though I don't have him in ours, so I'm not putting more pressure, but maybe they need to sit down at the table in front of us and help us understand how the programs can integrate, because that is a low-hanging fruit. Better education, more Alaskans working, makes your budget go down and makes your life easier.
Representative Wilson, directly onto that point, that's some of the things that, again, that I mentioned earlier. We're working with some of the other folks who look at healthcare costs, and so discussions I had with Jeff Jesse over at Mental Health Trust, broadband. I mean, education could use expanded broadband extensively to help reduce their costs and get more efficient and deliverable services and better services across the state. Corrections, judiciary. There's not a department out there, DNR. I mean, I look around at all you different co-chairs there. So what we're going to do, talk to Jeff Jesse about this, is have the trust do some research for us. How much broadband is needed in the state? You know, if we had the broadband at capacity that the department needs it, Department of Health and Social Services, for telemedicine, look what it costs to bring people from rural Alaska in for medical procedures and stuff that could be done through telemedicine. We could have better, more efficient, deliverable services to Alaskans and reduce our costs at the same time. And you each have your individual respective budgets that you're working on, the university. Look at that. Holy cow. So how much do we need in this state as a state administratively in our operating budget? What would it reduce us, or what do we need for broadband services? But then you add in oil industry, gas industry, mining industry, all private industries. How much broadband is required in the state of Alaska so that we're running at full efficiency, so that all eight cylinders are clicking? And we're gonna, so they're gonna work on that with us. And is there enough need for broadband for private industry to invest their money into installing that broadband so they can amortize their investment? And those are the types of proposals that we're going to be looking at that will help each and every one of us, because you said that this is, we all work individuals in silos, but that questionnaire would help every one of you as you know, overseers of budgets, and to help better deliverable services to Alaskans and reduce our costs at the same time, while maybe opportunities for private industry to invest their dollars back into Alaska, because we don't have capital dollars. We're in a deficit mode. That's a way that we can, you know, open more opportunities for business and industry to operate in Alaska, to create more jobs for Alaskans in a better manner. And so it's proposals like that that I'm going to be putting forward in opportunities like that to help that happen. and it reaches across to all of us. And so it's not going to just be us as individuals. It's going to be, again, working with the Mental Health Trust. It's going to be working with the Health Commission and each individual department as we go along to try and have better, efficient, deliverable services and reduce all our costs overall and make Alaska a better place for investment.
And just on that point, Mr. Chair, can you also look into why we're not sharing those services? When we were out in some of the bush communities, public safety might have it, but maybe OCS didn't have it, and a school had it, but another. So each one of those, you're paying individual service versus if all the agencies were being able to benefit off that. So that's one question I haven't been able to get answered is, what would it cost for everybody in that area versus, you know, just getting it to the community for one?
Well, we're going to ask Representative Holmes to work on the Department of Administration's budget there and ask the Commissioner of Administration.
I think that's a great idea.
Work on that, to how we can combine those services. But it's proposals like that that are going to help assist all of us in long-term budgeting, five-year long-term budgeting that's going to continue to help Alaska grow, better services to the people that we work for. I'm excited about some of these proposals, and we'll lay them out. To you, but that's just one little snapshot of where we're looking to. What we're trying to make Alaska a better place and help the commissioner along there and take some chagrin off of his people and the workload off of his. You know, one of the things that we heard up in Fairbanks is one of the OCS workers there, just because we've got a minute here and then we'll wrap up, had some foster kids that they're trying to deal with, homeless kids, youth from a village. And it takes 20 minutes to download one page. There's like five boxes they have to fill out in there. Takes half hour to do that, and then 20 minutes again just do another page, and they got 20 pages they have to do. It takes hours upon hours upon hours. Here we got youth or Alaskans in need who are without. We've got very frustrated workers who are trying to get this done because their caseload continues to increase by the minute, because there's more of those Alaskan kids or people who need help. And it just keeps backlogging on them. And they get more and more frustrated until they quit. You know, so we've got inefficiencies in the department there because they have trying to keep people in there. Every time you have to bring somebody in there, you lose 20, 25% of your efficiencies on personnel costs. So these are things that we're going to try and do, make the workplace a better place for Alaskans, try and reduce the amount of turnover in health and social service, a tremendous amount of turnover. Those are inefficiencies that will help this budget. So together... we'll all work together on trying to do that. Is any other further questions or comments? Thank you, Commissioner. That's our goal. I think we've kind of set the stage of where we want to do an open discussion instead of boilerplate. So that's where we're headed. Thank you all.